cliffcentral.com.
Grant, I need to make a critical business decision. We've been expanding rapidly, and my gut feel tells me that we should be investing for growth. But I need to put some financial science behind that gut feel of mine.
Don't you have a financial manager or director that can help you with that?
But isn't that rather expensive?
It doesn't have to be. Why don't you contact the finance team? They're a consultancy that can provide you with a part-time financial manager or director at a fraction of the cost of a full-time resource.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Welcome to our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the Finance Team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio as part of our panel is Safia Boulay of New Habits, Making Shift Happen. Welcome, Safia.
How's it, Richard?
Last week, we spoke to Adam Rabinowitz on the whole question of zero inventory business models, a great podcast. If you want to catch that, go to our website, the Cliff Central website, and you can download the show there. Today's theme, how to develop and protect intellectual capital. Joining us in studio is our guest, Ryan Tucker of RM Attorneys. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. So, I've started my business, I've developed a great product, and I'm wondering if I should do something to protect my ideas. Let's talk about this whole scenario of IP, intellectual property, trademarks, brands. Where do we start? I've got this great idea, great product. Should I be worrying about it or should I just let it go?
I think coming from an intellectual property lawyer, you should definitely be worrying about it. I think many businesses and entrepreneurs and startups, even some small to medium-sized businesses, perhaps underestimate the value that intellectual property rights provide for the business at the current time and in the future. Very often in my practice, I find that the business or the director of the business comes to me at the stage where the proverbial difficulties have already arisen.
Yeah.
And, he's trying to be tactful, he's on radio.
And instead of that, they should have actually come a lot earlier. Right at the beginning of their business, when they were naming their business or whether they were naming their products, they should have come to an intellectual property attorney for that. Also, if they're an inventor of some sort, they shouldn't be putting that out into the public domain before going to a patent attorney or an intellectual property attorney who can advise them properly. Also, another thing is that many times people don't really know the differences between the various intellectual property rights.
Let's talk about those.
Okay, so typically for inventions, we're talking about patents. Those might be methods or they might be products. For example, let's talk about the pharmaceutical industry. The method of coming up with a particular product may include steps 1, 2, and 3. The product itself, the actual drug that you take, may also be patentable as well. So that's a good example of an invention.
So you're saying each of the steps can also be patented?
Correct.
Okay. So you can simultaneously for one product hold multiple, so the process and the end product.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. So it's the end product and the means to get to the end product that you
so to speak
you need to be thinking about. Okay.
Then we're talking brands, as you mentioned earlier, which could be anything from a name, could be a combination of letters and numbers, could be a logo, and those are traditionally protected by trademarks. Okay. There are also what are called non-traditional trademarks, such as shapes, colors, and other what they call non-traditional trademarks, which have their own special requirements in terms of the law. And you need to be a little bit more careful when filing those applications. And I strongly recommend that you see a trademark or intellectual property attorney when trying to file those applications.
Yeah, I think this is one of those shows where I put out my normal warning, please consult with an expert on this matter. Yeah. We're going to give you some basic thoughts and thinking, but
there's no DIY here.
Yeah, this is not a DIY. Please do not try this at home. warning is on this show. So very clearly, Ryan, you pointed to the fact that there are some really intricate parts of this world, and it's important to make sure you get the right advice. But it's also important to have a good general understanding, so you know where you're going and why you're going and how you're going, so that you make sure that, you know, that things hang together properly. Okay, so, I mean, let's talk about potentially who's missed out on big opportunities to secure their idea, protect their brand, protect their intellectual capital. Give us some examples of things that go badly wrong. So it doesn't have to be specific people per se. Please don't name the victims here. But more, what are the types of things that people don't think about and that go pear-shaped on them, and down the line you go, well, if you'd been listening to a radio show, these are the things that you go, hey, if this happens or if this happens or if this happens, you need to think about these things. Give us some examples, practical examples.
Great. Okay, so let's say you've come up with some invention, a new lock system, and you don't necessarily think about getting a patent for it prior to launching it in, you know, to the public, selling it, or perhaps getting a manufacturer or distributor to distribute the product for you. There's a requirement in South African patent law that your invention needs to be novel before you can get a patent. That's one of the requirements. So once you have started selling that product, you lose novelty.
Okay.
And effectively your potential for obtaining a patent on that invention is lost. And that happens all the time.
Okay, so there's a real good how you miss it. Okay.
Other things, for example, people may go ahead with a certain trademark or trade name for their business without first conducting a trademark search for such name or logo or whatever it might be. And then, okay, initially they under the radar because they might be a small business, but as soon as they gain traction, the person who actually has the right, the registration, the trademark registration, and if it is in fact confusingly similar to what that company has come up with, then there might potentially be a trademark infringement action that's launched against client for that confusing similarity between the two marks.
Now, when we talk about company names specifically, I think there, and I know from having dealt with this, is we register a company name with the company registrar of companies. That does not automatically give us the rights to the trademark, as I understand it.
Correct. That's spot on. The two registers are completely separate.
They're independent. Okay.
The commissioners or the registrars who oversee those two registers do not necessarily search the other when someone is filing for, let's say, a trademark or filing a company name. So it's always best for clients if they see that their company name is in fact inventive or really a strong trademark, that they should file it as a company name as well as filing a trademark application for that. And that certainly bolsters the rights and the strength of that name going forward.
Yeah, so if you started out your world as Nike or Coca-Cola, you'd want to make sure that you've got both your company name as well as your trademark name reserved and protected.
Registered.
And registered.
But doesn't it apply to just about everyone, though? Because, I mean, I can't imagine that everyone starts a business hoping to fail. Everyone starts a business hoping to grow and be big one day.
Correct. But what I mean is that if you use a sort of descriptive name, Plumbing Johannesburg Pty Limited, you may be able to get the company name for it, but you're not necessarily going to get the trademark for it. So that's why I say...
Let's just quickly define what you need to get something trademarked. There must be some requirements,
correct,
out there.
So basically... There are several definitions that one needs to get through. Number one, it has to be a mark. A mark is defined in the Trademarks Act in the definitions. It's a sign that must be capable of being represented graphically. It can be a name, signature, logo, color, etc., etc. Then you must comply with the definition of trademark. A trademark is a mark, what we defined earlier, which is capable of distinguishing the goods and services of one individual from the goods and services of his competitor. Mm-hmm. And that is a critical definition. And then we look at Section 9 of the Trademarks Act, which describes that exact principle, the capability of distinguishing, the distinctiveness that is required of a trademark. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, we need to look at Section 10, which is the exemptions or defenses against the registrability of a trademark. So those are the four main criteria that the registrar would look at first of all in accepting or not accepting your trademark after filing. It also forms the basis of an opposition after you've advertised your trademark after acceptance by the registrar, and it also forms the basis of, even if you've got a registration for a trademark, some third party may be able to use Section 10 in order to expunge your trademark from the register. So those are really key factors when trying to register a trademark. And along with that, that's why I recommend to every business that they may have come up with a great trademark, but it's very crucial to conduct a trademark search first in order to determine what exists, what third-party rights exist on the register, so as to see whether that trademark is registrable and available for use by that business.
And I guess the reality is stringing a few words together, something like, let's use a name like Nike, you know, clearly doesn't have an English definition to it. We all know what the brand Nike actually represents now, and the likes, and many other names that, you know, what is Coca-Cola? Well, we all know it by its definition.
Or Google.
Or Google or something like that. But, you know, when you have the plumber of Johannesburg, well, you know, that's not really a trademark. You can't put a trademark on that because the name by its implication is descriptive of a whole lot of things, and you're going to find that's going to fail. So you know you've got to be really careful when you're starting to create a brand whether it's going to actually meet the definitions, as you know, in terms of those different sections. And you've got to think very carefully about whether the trade-off, I guess, of something, I guess you could call it known and quantifiable, so plumber Johannesburg is more useful in your business compared to saying I'm now called Google. What is a Google? Well, it's a plumber in Joburg, and people have to build brand association. But down the track, when somebody, we now use Google as a verb to say we actually say what we do with Google. So it's become that familiar in our language.
You raise an interesting point there about Google. Google recently in the United States was taken to court. Mm-hmm. A person had filed several trademark applications in the United States for Google something, Google X, Google Y, Google Z. And Google obviously were very unhappy with this. I mean, they take extreme lengths to make sure that their brand does not become generic for the word internet searching. So this person, took the word Google and added several, could we call them suffixes, to the term. Mm-hmm. And the court clearly said that notwithstanding the fact that there was this suffix that was added to Google, Google's rights remain intact. And Google's, the strength of Google, Google's trademark, the word Google itself, notwithstanding the fact that people use it as a verb, as you indicated, for internet search, Google still has rights in that word. And we can compare that to other trademarks that have become generic. For example, I don't know if you're aware of, but the word escalator and elevator were initially trademarks.
I didn't know that.
Aspirin were initially trademarks that have now become so ubiquitous and used so ubiquitously that they've become generic and have lost that distinctiveness that I referred to earlier in terms of the Trademarks Act.
Now, I mean, you're talking there of things that have kind of gone through the trademark and I guess become common language and moved out the other side. In intellectual property, I mean, give us some examples of where intellectual property has been well managed and well protected, both intellectual property, trademarks, brands, etc. Give us some examples of some of the stuff that you've seen done really well in the South African context, perhaps.
Okay, something like Bidvest. Mm-hmm. In terms of their brands, they are fantastic at protecting their brands. They have a house mark, Bidvest or Bid, and they are, as I'm sure you're aware, highly diversified company with various different businesses and sub-businesses. And they use that house brand very well, and they use sub-brands very well. And that portfolio, which may be in excess of, I'm not sure, 50, 60, 70 brands.
Sure, yeah. Bigger than that, yeah.
Perhaps even more, is very well managed by a particular person within Bidvest. Maybe has other roles as well, but one of his roles is definitely to look after the Bidvest name, brand, and make sure that his trademarks, that Bidvest trademarks, are renewed on time, are managed correctly, that people, for example, don't start squatting on the domain name register using the word Bid or Bidvest or some sort of confusingly similar name.
Sorry, squatting?
I'm not sure you're aware of, but basically in terms of South African law and much like elsewhere, like .com, there's a first-to-file system for getting a domain, a URL. Okay. So let's say if you look at mine, rmtucker.co.za, okay, the first to file was me and I get the rights. But if, for example, someone were to change one letter and say rmtocker, rmtucker or something like that, because there's just that one change, the domains register doesn't pick it up initially as a confusingly similar domain. And it will allow that person to register that domain. However, me, that's clearly affecting my reputation. And it's clearly, in my mind, an abuse of registration in terms of the domain name regulations. So I would be entitled to file a complaint with the South African Institute of Intellectual Property Law to ensure that that trademark, or that domain name, will be given to me because it's clearly in violation of my rights. Correct.
Okay.
Even though I may not use it,
yeah,
but it's in someone else's hands,
yeah,
it certainly affects my reputation, okay, and could be considered a passing off of my trademark and my brand.
Okay. Okay.
So if we look at some other examples which are classic, like for example in China, this has happened to me many times. Clients have been have received an email from someone from the registry, the domain registry in China, or a trademark attorney in China, stating, well, we've noted that someone has registered your trademark as a domain name in China. You have 5 days in which to respond to that. It's going to cost you XYZ dollars. And they put the fear of God into clients. And clients sometimes, you know, comply. Whereas in actual fact, there's a procedure there in China that you can make sure that your domain name is protected. So I've just heard recently that squatting is happening on the Chinese trademark register, which up until now I hadn't heard about. So what's happening there is trademark attorneys themselves are filing and registering, or at least filing trademarks in China for, let's say, Bidvest, RM Tucker, whatever it might be. And then they are trying to solicit money from the actual owner of that trademark in South Africa.
So it's a hostage situation.
Correct.
Wow.
But normally, I mean, the fact that the person is actually charging you more than what it would cost to register that domain on your own is sufficient evidence for the court or for whoever's dealing with it to say, well, this might be a little bit dodgy and might be an abuse of registration.
Okay.
Yeah, it always worries me when you get those Chinese moments with some different system. I mean, I guess let's, seeing that we've gone there, the whole question of China, I mean, we all know that, you know, everybody goes China, they copy anything and everything. You know, then we get into this question of the grey market goods world. Talk to us for a moment about intellectual property and grey market, because I think people often are confused as to what a grey market good is, and should they be worried about this? Shouldn't they be? What is the relevance? You know, is it a good idea? Not a good idea? Should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? You know, parallel import question. Talk to us about that.
Okay, so I've got a blog post on it on my website. You can certainly have a look at that. www.rmtucker.co.za. Look at blog posts. Or it could be under my newsletters. I forget. It could be between the two of them. But basically, to answer your question in one sentence, parallel imports are not illegal.
Okay.
So people often think that the fact that, you know, the licensee in South Africa is not the person who is selling the goods. They believe that that those goods are in fact counterfeit, but that's not the case. So let me explain just a simple scenario about how parallel imports could work, and a good example of how the courts in South Africa have dealt with it. So, for example, you've got a major clothing brand. Let's call it Nike. Let's say Nike. And Nike has several licensees all over the world, but it authorizes in Taiwan or China to produce a certain shoe in China. And it's got an agent there that affixes the Nike trademark to the goods. Someone else, another party, not the licensee in South Africa, not the licensee in Taiwan or China, purchases 1,000 pairs of shoes from the Taiwanese manufacturer and brings it into South Africa and sells them. There's nothing illegal about that. The only thing that would affect that is that the licensee in South Africa would not, the purchaser of those parallel goods would not be afforded the warranty or guarantee that a local licensee would afford. And this happens very often in electronic goods. And the cases are very much on those. There's the Canon case and the Kodak case. So if I can put it simply, if the goods are genuine, by genuine, I mean that the owner of the trademark or his agent has affixed the trademark in the foreign country, and the person has bought those goods and brought them into South Africa and has not altered them or modified them in South Africa or during the passage to South Africa, those goods remain genuine. The only thing is that issue of warranty. Okay. The licensee in South Africa is very unlikely to afford to the person who purchased those parallel goods the warranty. Having said that, I'm not sure if you're aware of the Consumer Protection Act. There's a provision in the Consumer Protection Act which provides for an implied warranty on those goods. So even though you may not be able to get the warranty on the goods with the particular licensee, you would have an implied warranty with the person who's selling the so-called grey goods parallel imported goods. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So basically your recourse goes back to the person who sold you the goods.
But not necessarily the brand.
So not necessarily the brand. So... let's use an example. I buy my TV from a provider of Grey Import or Grey Market. I don't go back to Samsung with my TV. I go back to the person who sold me the goods. And in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, they actually have an obligation to provide me with the support that I'm looking for.
Correct.
Okay, so I guess that answers the question around the grey markets. I guess we also got to be really careful, though, around the, let me call them the copy
scenario. The counterfeit.
The counterfeit.
Market, yeah.
Market. And that's an entirely different space. So that Cartier watch that I can buy for 100 Rand, it's not the real thing. And it's not, it might be made in the same factory. I don't know, there's often this debate of, well, if it's made in the same factory and it looks the same, is it the same? And I guess, you know, you're left with this question of, well, it doesn't carry the brand and it's often not branded or trademarked correctly. It might be, you know, it always amazes me how something that looks like the original branding, except there's a slight change or something from the original. It's amazing how they try and pass off something that's counterfeit as original. But the reality is, you are then straight into the world of, it's not the genuine item, so the brand that you think you're buying, you're not. And you're now just buying an item off the shelf from another person. Often, even if it is made in the same factory, the reality is you've got no guarantees, no warranties, and no representation from the brand and the intellectual property holder that stands behind that item. And I think there's many people that will say, well, it's made in the same factory. It's made to the same standards. So I'm going to give it a fly and try and use it anyway because, hey, how bad can this be? Unfortunately, the reality is often that sort of stuff is where it is because it hasn't got the level of, let's call it, checks and validation.
Quality control.
Okay. So you've then got to realize that you're taking on yourself the burden of quality controlling the item in question, and you've got to realize that, hey, this is my responsibility, and I've got to make sure that, you know, I'm taking that seriously. It is a case of, unfortunately, I guess, buyer beware.
Absolutely.
In that case. So, Ryan, I guess my question to you would be, as we close off today, what is the one thing around intellectual property that for you stands out as the most important thing that a business person should be thinking about?
I think that the most important thing is maybe something that I alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. is that it's always thought of that legal services are that, what would we call it, a grudge purchase, particularly mm-hmm. up front for a startup or an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And I think that for many people, they don't realize the value that those intellectual property assets might have going forward. For example, in number one, negotiating joint venture agreements, distributions, all that sort of stuff. Even getting some time with a pick and pay or a discount or whatever it might be. The fact that you have a patent in place puts you in a much stronger position than you would be without it. Also, the same goes for trademarks as well. I think that once you've trademarked something, or at least are in the process of trademarking something, you certainly are in a better position when it comes to building your product, building your business. And I strongly recommend that new businesses, any businesses, seek out the advice of intellectual property experts in order to facilitate their protection of their intellectual property, whether it be a patent, whether it be a trademark, whether it be a design, whether it be copyright. All those sort of things, I think, are critical to discuss with your intellectual property attorney going forward. Also, a good idea is to get onto the web and get a good understanding of what the different intellectual property rights are. Know what you're really looking at protecting before even reaching the intellectual property attorney. That may cut out half the consultation fee that is necessary for that particular consultation. So those are the two main things that I would say. Don't wait for the proverbial stuff to hit the fan. Get in early. Don't see it as a grudge purchase. Don't see your intellectual property attorney as a scary person who's looking to take you on. We really are people that are trying to assist entrepreneurs and people generally.
Great. Ryan, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate your insights. Next up is our business conversation. Stay with us. CliffCentral.com.